Herzlich willkommen. Welcome for Computer Graphics. So on Monday, no, that's also wrong. Sorry, I'm totally confused. Okay, let me start again. Okay, welcome for Computer Graphics. So last week we were speaking about occlusion and I told you about the set buffer, a very simple way to generate occlusion. And the general idea is that for every pixel in our image, we store a depth value. And whenever we rasterize something, we interpolate depth for every pixel. And then before we write a pixel, we make a so-called C-test or set-test that tests whether the new pixel is in front of the previously drawn geometry or maybe behind. And if it's behind, then we did work, which was for nothing because we simply throw away the pixel. But by this, we can achieve visibility, we can achieve correct occlusion. It's a very efficient algorithm. It works nicely and avoids all these problems that we learned that, for instance, the Painter algorithm has where we try to sort triangles from back to front. We can avoid all that with a set buffer. There's one noticeable exception, which is transparency. And this is what I want to speak about now in the next 5 minutes before we start with the next large section today about lighting. The idea of transparency is that maybe we do not only have objects that are opaque. Opaque is just the opposite of transparent. Opaque means that no light penetrates an object. Most objects that we have are opaque, but sometimes we also have transparent objects, like glass objects or windows or stuff like that. And maybe we also want to be able to handle these. And in fact, at first sight, it's not very difficult to do so. And the technique that is applied in use in computer graphics to handle transparency is so-called alpha blending. And the idea is the following. I need my nice pointer. Where is it? No, here we are. Okay, so the idea is to use so-called alpha blending. And here you can already see a result of alpha blending. So you see that red circle obviously is in front of the blue one. And it's transparent, because we can still see the blue rectangle here in the background. And the idea now is whenever we draw that red circle here for all pixels, we do not simply overwrite the previous color, in this case the blue, but we blend the new color with the previous one. We mix. A simple way to mix would just be to average. So we could, for instance, say the new color is one half of the old color plus one half of the new one. Then we have a 50% mixing that sort of corresponds to 50% transparency. But of course, we cannot only take 50%, but can take an arbitrary value. And this value is here stored in the alpha value. This alpha describes how transparent, or more the other way around, how opaque a new a rendered rasterized object is. And then it's just the weighted average between the old and the new pixel value. Okay, that works. And it delivers good results. But if you think a little bit about it, you realize that it assumes that the red circle is drawn before the blue one. So this only works if we render transparent objects on top of previously drawn ones. And if we are in 3D, that means the red circle must be drawn after the blue one. And essentially that means, again, we have to sort our objects from back to front. So that when we rasterize the transparent object, all the objects behind have already been rasterized, so we can mix the colors correctly. Okay, so that's kind of the problem, yeah? So how is it done in practice? Nevertheless, transparency is often used, and usually this alpha value that we've just seen here is stored as an additional component of color, and it's stored in a kind of fourth color component. Yeah, so usually, or often, very often, we can define colors not only as RGB triples, but as quadruples, where the last channel is this transparency value. So our color, for instance, could be 1000.1, which is a very transparent red. Yeah, 0.1 means very low opacity. And if we want to have opaque objects, yeah, then we set alpha to 1. This corresponds to a completely opaque object. And yeah, so 0, 1, 0, 1 is completely opaque green. And if we look at the equation for blending, then we see that the pixel color after the blending is just the new color, yeah, which is a simple override. Okay, yeah, so that can be handled very easily. Taking RGBA instead of RGB is often very convenient, because if you take 8 bits per channel, then you have 32 bits per pixel, which is most often something like a word in computer memory. For computer architectures, taking 4 values instead of 3 is often even more convenient. And we just take that fourth channel to store transparency. So, unfortunately, that doesn't mean that we can simply now, yeah, make everything transparent and don't have to think about it anymore. And the reason, as said, is that alpha blending is not commutative. What does that mean? Let's say we render two rectangles, a red one and a green one, and we render them on top of a white background. Yeah. So what you see here is that we, yeah, obviously it also looks like the red is in front of the green one. So we first render So we first render the green rectangle over white, yeah? So the green is blend with a white background, which makes it a rather whitish or bright green. And then on top we render red, yeah? And you see this result, and if we swap red and green, then we get this result, yeah? And now here it looks like green is in front and red is in back. Yeah, so you see now the order in which the rectangles have been rendered. Yeah, and that's not the result that you want to achieve. Yeah, you want to have independent in which order we render these rectangles, we want to have a right result. Yeah, because when we rasterize such a 3D scene, we don't want to sort objects from back to front. Yeah, and we cannot always say which one is in front of the other without making computations. So, yeah, we have a problem here, and we cannot handle that without additional effort. Yeah, just because this alpha blending is not commutative. And then there's another problem, and that is that the set buffer and transparency, yeah, there's an interplay between these two. So let's assume we have two semi-transparent spheres, like this one, and one is in front, the first one is in, or sphere one is in front of sphere two. And now we first, for some reason, we first render sphere one with a set buffer, yeah? So we fill all the set values in this buffer, and then we render sphere number two, and now, because of the occlusion test, the set buffer test, yeah, here in the overlapping areas, all the pixels will be discarded before they can be blended, yeah, just because the order is sort of incorrect, and as a result, yeah, they will look like totally opaque, yeah, no transparency will be visible anymore, because the set test already does this. And if we do it the other way around, yeah, first render two and then one, then we get a right result. Yeah, so implicitly the set buffer assumes that the objects are opaque. And once a pixel has been set, yeah, nothing behind is visible anymore. Yeah, so these two also don't work together very well. And ideally, no, so we have to find a solution for that, or we can think about solutions, of course. And the practical way to do so is that usually, first of all, we take all the opaque objects in our scene, which should be the majority. Yeah, so that assumes that we only have a few transparent objects. And we first of all render all these opaque objects, yeah, with a normal C buffer. So this already gives us a correct result for the opaque objects. And then we have to find a solution for the transparent ones. And often the best thing we can do is that we now simply take the transparent object, sort them from back to front, yeah, do a sorting only for the transparent objects, render them back to front, and in that case, don't use the set buffer. I mean, if we really render back to front, it doesn't matter anyhow. But then we don't need the set buffer anymore. Yeah. And now the sorting of the transparent objects, if it's only a handful, then it's okay. We might even think about really only sorting on object level. That means not sorting all the triangles, but sorting single objects, which often delivers slight artifacts that are difficult to notice. Yeah, if you, for instance, consider this bunny object that we already were looking at last time, yeah, it has these ears, and if you render it transparent and you render it in the wrong order, then maybe sometimes the ear, where the ear hides the back of the bunny, then this effect might happen. Yeah, that sometimes the ear maybe has the wrong color because it's rendered in the wrong order, but it doesn't get visible immediately. Yeah, so we can do the sorting only on object level, and often this is still okay. Yeah, so the possible ways to handle it is really to not use the set buffer and sort all objects, that means all triangles back to front. Or, as said before, don't sort the opaque objects, but render these and then only sort transparent objects. Or first render the opaque objects, and then render transparent objects, maybe even without sorting. That means now only if two transparent objects overlap, we get artifacts, or at least only sort on object level, so that the worst errors are avoided. Yeah, but very often, or sometimes that's really an approximate way to handle that. Okay, of course, there are better methods, that are more efficient and that don't deliver artifacts. Yeah? In some cases, maybe transparent objects are very important. I won't detail on this here in this lecture. Yeah? This is something we will hear about in interactive computer graphics, for instance. There are some extra slides that give you a first idea on how this could be handled. There's an approach that is called depth peeling, and here the idea is that we don't really sort the objects as triangles, but we sort them during rasterization. And the general idea is that, for instance, we can rasterize all objects as if they were opaque. Yeah, then we get kind of the, for every pixel, we get the frontmost layer of our scene. And then we store this depth buffer, keep it somewhere in memory, and render the scene again. And now all depth values from this front layer are also discarded, and for the rest, the set buffer is working. So as a result, we get the second depth layer. And we do that multiple times, and then we get layer-wise our scene, single depth layers, and we get them automatically sorted from front to back. And all these images we can then blend again back to front using transparency values, and we get a right image. But of course, we need to render the scene multiple times, which is costly. But if nice effects are to be achieved, it works. But as I said, it's also not relevant for the exam. Yeah, but if you're interested in this, depth peeling is the right word to search for. Okay, good. So are there any questions on this before we start with the next larger chapter? No? Okay, the next thing we will speak about is lighting. And maybe to introduce lighting, I will show you a little demo, which again doesn't work. Here we are. And so we don't need to look at this code here up to now. The important part is that image of a bunny here, yeah? And what you see now is in contrast to how the bunny looked like in previous examples, that obviously there's now something like a shading on this object. Yeah, and if you look at that, probably most people would, or I hope so, that most people would say, obviously this bunny is lit, yeah, by something like a light source, which is positioned roughly here, yeah, because here it's bright, and here in the back it's darker. Yeah, if I look from that, yeah, you see that it's almost completely dark here, but from that direction, yeah, it is lit. And yeah, this gives a much more three-dimensional impression of our object, yeah, because we have some very simple kind of lighting simulation on the object. Yeah, and from the simulation, we can see faces or parts of the objects that are facing the light sources and others that are not. And additionally, we also have an idea of the material of the object, yeah, because obviously that object, I would say, is not of metal, because then it would look more glossy. Yeah, it's more diffuse, maybe more paper or something like that. Yeah, but we can change that. Go a little bit closer. Yeah, what we can also add is here now glossy lighting. Yeah, now we have such highlights on the object. Yeah, and these tell us even more where a light source is, yeah, because these are reflections of the light source. Yeah, it's a reflection of the light that is illuminating that scene. And we can even change the direction of our light source. Yeah, and you see the effect, and it really looks like we move a light source around this object here. We can change it in up and down and rotate it around our object. And we can also change the color, of course, of our object. Yeah, that's very, very simple. Let's make it more bluish. Yeah, now we have a bluish object, and so forth. Yeah, so that means with this lighting, yeah, we get, first of all, an impression of where light sources are. We get a probably or hopefully better impression of the shape of the object. It looks more three-dimensional. And we also get an impression of the material of the object. Yeah, what is it made of? Is it more glossy? And so forth. And yeah, this is essentially what we will speak about today. How can we compute these colors? Yeah, and how can we do that? And you see that here on the left already. How can we do that in shaders? Because this is essentially, one of the major purposes of shaders. That's also why they are called shaders, yeah, because they shade pixels. Very simple. They compute a color for pixels. Okay. So, how does that work, or where does it happen? So, I already told you that usually we consider this imaging process that we are speaking about here can normally be organized as a pipeline. And we were already speaking about the pipeline between a 3D object And the rasterizer in this pipeline is mainly a pipeline in which transformations are computed. Yeah, so we have here a pipeline where we have given triangles in some model space, yeah, and then we apply the model transformation, the camera transformation, the perspective mapping, yeah, the perspective transformation, and then the objects go to the rasterizer. Yeah, from here on now we are in image space, and we have now lots of pixels, and now in the lighting, or the purpose of lighting, is to compute colors for these pixels. And we don't want to compute these colors just by having attributes on the object. Yeah, so you also saw we can give colors as attributes to vertices and then interpolate them. But we want to compute these colors on the fly during rendering, because yeah, here, if you look at a particular pixel or a particular or at some part of the object here, for instance, the cheek, yeah, the color changes with the view direction. Yeah, so we have to recompute these colors every frame, and we cannot compute this on the CPU and upload. I mean, we can do so, but that would be very inefficient. Yeah, in fact, we want to compute these colors on the fly while rendering. Yeah, so we need a lighting model that is so efficient that we can compute it per pixel and per frame. Yeah, so this is the stage in which we are doing that. Yeah, so when we rasterize, yeah, and we have one particular pixel and we want to set that pixel, we call a pixel shader or a fragment shader, and the fragment shader then computes the single or the one color for that pixel. And yeah, how does this work? Yeah. In fact, we do something like a very much simplified lighting computation for now. And we say, okay, we have a surface point. Yeah, this pixel corresponds to a point on our 3D object. We say we have something like one or maybe multiple light sources that illuminate our scene. And we have a camera that looks at this point from a particular direction, because the color of that point also depends on the direction from which we look at the point. Yeah? So this is sort of our input. And now we do something like a physical lighting simulation that tells us, okay, for this particular point, how much light arrives at that point from the light source or from the light sources, and how much of that light is reflected towards the camera. And yeah, this happens, as I said, in the shaders. We will later see that we can do this computation in the vertex or in the fragment shader. State of the art is definitely to do it in the fragment shader. But yeah, as I said, we can also do it in a vertex shader. We will see that later on. And then we simply write a program like this one here. Yeah. And you see that's a fragment shader. It computes the frag color. And now here, this is a formula to compute color. That's a very, very simple way. Yeah. So you see maybe mostly, yeah, it's a very, very short term. And this does compute a color. And it's, yeah, in this example, only one line of code. So it can be done very efficiently. It generates such shadings as we saw before. Okay, at least the first variant. Okay, so lighting. Yeah, how does lighting work? In fact, we have to look at light transport in a virtual scene, and there we will see. Yeah, here we have a simple scene, a floor and a wall maybe, and we have a virtual or a light source positioned in that scene. And we have a camera here depicted by the eye. And now light propagates from the light source through the room. It will hit objects in the room, will reflect light, and some reflected light goes to the eye. Yeah? It's only a very small reflection, a very small fraction of the light that comes to the eye, yeah, but a small fraction of the emitted light hits the eye, and then yeah, we can measure it somehow, and a pixel gets brighter. And light cannot only go from the light source via one surface to the eye. Obviously, light can also directly from the light source go to the eye. This path is missing here. Yeah, I can directly look into a light source. Or it can also go indirectly. Yeah, so it can be that light first bounces off here, and then goes to the eye. Yeah, that would be indirect light, or we have direct light. This is light that only bounces once. Yeah. And I think you can imagine that simulating the direct transport one bounce is still rather simple, yeah, because then we only have this single event here. But if we have multiple bounces, things can become very complicated, yeah, because the color of this point, of course, does not only contribute or depend on this indirect illumination via this point, yeah, but all other points can contribute to the color of that point if we also look into indirect light, yeah. So things can become very complicated. And so, in fact, yeah, there's also different names for that. If we only look at the light that is reflected once, yeah, from the light source, reflected once, and then going to the eye, this light is usually called direct light or local light. We will see why local, yeah? And all the light that has more indirections, yeah, multiple bounces, is called indirect light or global lighting. Yeah? And global lighting is much more difficult to compute, but if you want to achieve realistic effects, it's necessary to compute that. Yeah, if you want to go beyond that plastic bunny that you've seen there, then you will need global effects. Yeah, so for every movie that you see in the cinemas, yeah, there the global lighting problem has been solved in some maybe simplified way, yeah, but a lot of time is only spent on computing a realistic lighting. For now, we will ignore that. We will come back to global illumination effects later on when we speak about ray tracing. But for now, we only look at local lighting. Yeah, so we only look at light coming from a light source, bouncing off a surface, and then going to the eye. Okay, so it makes sense to look at what can happen with light that hits a surface. Yeah, if we want to somehow compute that, yeah, we first need to think about, yeah, what can happen with a photon that hits a surface. Yeah? And I mean, computational wise, the simplest thing that can happen is that the photon or a light hitting a surface is simply absorbed. Yeah? This happens quite often. Normal surfaces reflect maybe 50% of the incident light. Yeah? That means every second photon roughly is absorbed in the surface. It slightly heats up the surface. But you cannot see any effect. Yeah? It's simply absorbed. Another possibility is that light is reflected, and reflected in that sense mean that it's reflected like off a mirror. Yeah? And this can also be described physically, yeah, with corresponding equations. Light is an electromagnetic wave, and this can be reflected like from a mirror, and it's very simple to describe that. Yeah, because incident angle equals excitant angle. That means, yeah, if I know where a photon is coming from, I can exactly say or compute in which direction it's reflected. Yeah, that's how a mirror works. It's a perfect reflection. All incoming photons are perfectly reflected into reflection direction. Yeah. But our world obviously does not only consist of mirrors, yeah, but we have objects that reflect light in a different way. And what there usually happens is that these surfaces don't have a perfectly flat surface, but they have some microsurface. Yeah, they have some roughness. We don't see that roughness. Yeah, or we only see it if we take a microscope. Yeah, so that's why we call that microscopic. So they have a microscopic structure. And now reflection happens on this microscopic structure. And because we don't see these little bumps in our microscopic structure, All that we see is that the light is scattered somehow. It's reflected, but not in the perfect direction, but in different directions. Yeah? And how much it is scattered, yeah, and how this reflection looks like can give much hints about the surface itself. Yeah? Some surfaces are almost mirrors. They are almost perfect, but not completely. Like, for instance, metal, yeah, which is very well polished. Yeah, so it's almost like a mirror, but not really. Yeah, you see a blurry reflection. Others are, yeah, and on the other side of the spectrum, we have completely diffuse surfaces. And completely diffuse means that the surface is so rough that the reflection direction is completely random. Yeah, so we cannot, yeah, light coming in is bounced off this scattered surface somehow, so it leaves the surface at a random direction. And these surfaces we call diffuse surfaces. And there are all things in between diffuse and perfect mirrors, and this continuum we somehow have to describe. There are two more effects, which we won't look into today, but later on. The first one is refraction. Refraction means that light cannot only be reflected, but also refracted. Like if you have a water surface, for instance, yeah, then light can also penetrate the surface. And I mean, you know these typical effects, yeah, that objects seem to be bent by the water surface and so on. We will also come back to that later. Or see how we can simulate that when we do ray tracing. And then there's transmission, and in fact, from a physical point of view, this cannot really happen, but sometimes it's assumed as a substitute for refraction. If we simply assume that light does not change its direction, but it's just going through the medium, yeah, then we have what we call transmission. It's like transparency that we've seen 10 minutes ago. Okay, but for now we will look on this side here, yeah, where light is really reflected, but the interesting question is into which direction is it reflected? Okay, so before we can compute that, we have to think about what is usually given. And to describe that problem, we usually have the following parameters. So first of all, we have a point X on an object. As I said before, we compute the color for a particular pixel, but usually we say, okay, this pixel represents a surface point on our 3D object. So we first of all have to find the corresponding surface point in 3D, which is not difficult if we understand how projection works, yeah, because then one solution, it's not the best, yeah, but one solution would be that we take the image coordinates and the depth values, yeah, and apply the inverse matrices, and then we come back to the world point, yeah, that corresponds to this point. So, yeah, for every pixel that we light, we know its 3D position in the world. Yeah, we know where on the bunny this one pixel, the center of this pixel, yeah, on which position on the bunny this is. And then further on, what we need is an information about the orientation of the surface. You remember that I said, yeah, we see that the object, or there's a light source here because there are surfaces that are brightest, and this is obviously the case when the surface is directly facing the light source. Yeah? If the light comes from a grazing angle, then the surface becomes darker, and if it's facing, then it becomes brighter. So we need a way to measure the orientation in our surface point of the surface, and this is specified by the so-called surface normal. That's a vector that is perpendicular on the surface. We were already speaking about surface normal in the transformations, and we saw how we can also transform these surface normals for an arbitrary, affine transformation at least. Okay, so this is the local information about our point. Yeah, where are we and how is the surface in this point oriented? Furthermore, we have light sources. And these light sources, for now, or there are two simple ways for light sources. The first one are point light sources. That's a point in space. And we say, okay, here's a point, and this point emits light energy with some intensity. Yeah, so we have a 3D position in space, PI, and we have an intensity of that light source. We will see how we handle intensities later. An alternative are lights like sunlight. Yeah, the sun obviously is very far away. So it's a good approximation to say that the light from the sun, yeah, all light rays coming from the sun are parallel. In fact, that's not true, but it's a simple approximation. And these are called so-called parallel light sources. Yeah, so we say that's a light source that always shines from a certain direction. Yeah, so all light rays are parallel. So that's number two. And finally, we need the viewer position, because the color of a point can depend on from where I look at that point. Yeah. So I also need the position from which I look at that point. Okay. And now we determine the color of a point X lit by these lights Li when looked at from viewer position V. Yeah, that's the problem statement. And this is what we call local illumination. And the reason is that, yeah, with this simple model, all we can compute, we only know information about the surface point that we are looking at. Yeah, we only have local information. Where is that point and what's its surface normal? But we don't know the rest of the scene. We only have local information. Yeah. And if we want to compute also indirect light, for instance, via this wall to this point, yeah, we would also need to know that there is a wall here so that we can compute the indirect light via this wall at this point. Yeah. So to compute indirect light, we need information about the entire scene. Yeah. We need global knowledge. And that is why it's called global illumination. To compute local illumination, we only need to know that single point here and where are the light sources and where is the viewer. Yeah. But from the geometry of the scene, we only need to know local information from that point. And that's much easier to compute. Yeah. And if we think in a pixel shader, for instance, yeah, it's only the local information that we have. We only know the current triangle. Yeah. And one noticeable thing that with this global, local model cannot be computed are shadows. Because local information means we only know information about that point. And a shadow would appear if there is, for instance, here an object in between the light source and that point. But to know that there is an object in between would already, again, be global knowledge. And we cannot have that global knowledge in a rasterization pipeline as we learned it here, yeah, because we are rasterizing triangle by triangle. And in fact, it can be that the first triangle we draw, yeah, is shadowed by the 10 millionth triangle that is rasterized just at the very end. So when we rasterize the first triangle, we cannot know whether it's in shadow or not. We can only decide about that if we know the entire scene. Yeah. So that also explains why global illumination is much more complicated than local. Yeah. Or the other way around, why in an interactive context, usually people only look at local lighting, yeah, because we don't have the time budget to do all that global stuff and can only make a local consideration. Okay, yeah, so we can ask, yeah, so what does local illumination ignore in contrast to global? Yeah, if we make that simplification, it makes sense to understand how much we simplify. And I already said shadows, yeah, are an effect that by pure local illumination is not considered. Soft shadows is even a variant. where we don't have point lights, but larger lights. So we also have penumbra regions, yeah, not only full shadow or fully lit, but also things in between. Yeah, these arise from area light sources. This we will ignore. Light exchange between objects and light sources. So indirect lighting in particular, also between objects themselves. Yeah, so that a wall is illuminated and by this becomes itself an indirect light source that illuminates other objects in a scene. Yeah, all this is missing in local illumination. It's difficult to integrate these effects into a rasterization pipeline because we always only have local information. And the typical way, if we want to do global illumination, is that we need another way to render our images, typically ray tracing. And this is what we will speak about roughly in December. So at the end of the lecture, we will look at more sophisticated global illumination effects also. Okay, but for now, yeah, we start with a simple thing, local illumination. Of course, these color or lighting computations consider color. And we will, for now, also simply do that by using RGB triples. Yeah, so that means for all these values that you compute here, you must imagine that these values are triples of red, green, and blue. Yeah, and whenever we multiply two colors, we just multiply the RG and B channels, for instance. Yeah, and we can just do all these computations separately for the red, for the green, and for the blue channel. Yeah, that's also definitely not the best possible way, but for now, it's okay. And in fact, for lighting computation, there are many, many methods around. Of course, that's a very elementary effect, yeah, how surfaces, how material interacts with light, very relevant in many applications. And there are many such models that describe that, very physically based ones with tons of parameters and stuff like that. And the lighting model we will look at now is called Fong lighting. Fong was a guy, one of the first guys doing computer graphics in the 70s, I think. And in fact, Fong was his first name. But since the names are swapped in Asia, somehow it was referred to as Fong lighting. That's the way under which it's the name under which it is still known today, and it's really an ad hoc method. If you think about the problem a little bit, probably you would need half a day in the end to define that model. But it turned out to be very, very useful and practical, and it's still the kind of de facto standard in computer graphics. It's only partially based on physics. Yeah, there are some physics-related terms, but others are really just out of the box. Works, looks nice, is okay. And it has very simple material parameters, so it's very simple to find or to choose parameters that roughly give the look that you want, but very often you want to have a look that this model just doesn't support. Yeah, all objects with this model, so you will see that, always look a little bit like plastic. Yeah, so it's very difficult to get more natural looking, a more natural look with this lighting model. There are other models that are more flexible, that support more sorts of material, and we will come back to that at the end of this lecture, or probably on Thursday. Okay, so Fong lighting model, this is the situation given. We have a surface point, we have a light source, and we have a camera, and the orientation of the surface is described by the surface normal. That's a vector that is perpendicular on the surface. And for now, it is not important for us exactly where the camera is, but only the direction towards the camera, which we call V. And also, it's for now not important where the light source is, but only the direction to the light source, which we call L. So L, N, and V are unit vectors. Yeah, they are directions. And this is the input for our model. Yeah? Later on, we will see that the distance between X and the light source also plays a role. Yeah, obviously, the further away a light source, yeah, the darker the reflection must be. Yeah, but we will come back to that later. For now on, the situation looks like that. Or like that, that we have a directional light source. Yeah, this is for a point light source. That means, first of all, we compute the direction of X to the point light source. This gives us L. And for a directional light, L is simply a constant. Yeah, light always comes from the same direction. And for a point light source, yeah, we have the position of the light source given, and then we have to compute, the direction. Yeah, for a surface point, if we want to do the lighting, we compute the vector to L. That's a very simple formula. You can see that here. Yeah, it's just the difference between, yeah, the vector from X to P and normalized. That means divided by its length. So it's a unit vector. Okay, yeah, so here again, how this looks like. Yeah, and also for the camera, we can do the same computation and compute the vector towards the camera. For the light sources, again, yeah, point lights or parallel lights, these are, again, only approximations. In practice, it is not possible to generate a light source that is only a point. A light source always has some extent. And these are so-called area light sources. And I think you can imagine that the lighting, and in particular shadows generated by an area light source, look different from those of a virtual point light source that doesn't exist. Yeah, so these point lights are a simplification. So area light sources would be much more general, or another generalization are so-called spotlights. A spotlight, or for now, we always assume that these point lights emit light equally into all directions. And a spotlight is a light source that mainly emits into a particular direction. Yeah, and so we have to provide a direction and have to say how fast and in which range the light falls off to zero, yeah, how this spot looks like. Then we can achieve spotlights. Yeah. So that's a very simple extension of what we do here. Area light sources are much more complicated. And this is then real global illumination. Okay, so Phong lighting now, yeah, is consisting of three parts. Yeah, in the Phong lighting model, we say that the reflection of a surface is composited of three different parts: ambient light, diffuse light, and specular light. And it's probably easiest to see the difference if we show these contributions separately. So here we have such a blob object, and on this object, what we see here is the so-called diffuse light. Yeah, this was in the demo at the beginning when I showed the bunny first. Yeah, it had also this look. Yeah, it looks very matte. So very smooth. And this is what we will call diffuse. We will see in a minute how we can compute that. And then I turned on also these glossy highlights. This is what we call specular light or glossy light. And here you can see these two, yeah, summed up. And yeah, now you see the diffuse is kind of the basic color. And then there are these white spots. And this gives this plastic look. And what is in fact missing is this ambient part here. And this ambient part is just constant over the entire object. And this is just a kind of base color, yeah. So it helps, for instance, if you look at this very object from the back, yeah, all the light will come from the other side. So as a result, the back would be completely black. We would see nothing. Yeah, and because that's unrealistic. Yeah, if I take an object, and okay, if I would turn off this projector here, so all the light comes from here, obviously from this object I still can see something here in the back, and it's not directly illuminated but indirectly, by other objects in that scene, so there is some light here. Computing that indirect light would mean global illumination, which is too costly. So the approximation that one can do is that we just say, okay, nothing is black. There's always something like ambient light in a scene, and this is this constant part here. And these are the three terms, ambient plus diffuse plus specular. And these together are the Phong lighting model. And the simplest part, of course, is ambient light. It's the simplest and probably wrongest part of the Phong lighting model. Objects that are not directly lit are still visible. And this is an effect of global illumination. Indirect light, light coming from other objects to the site. And because it's too expensive to calculate it exactly, we just, what we typically do is that we say, okay, we have an ambient light source. This has no position or whatsoever in space. It's just a global constant. And every object has an ambient reflection coefficient. This is called this k-amp here. I-amp is the ambient light source, the ambient color, and k-amp is a coefficient that is chosen per object. And it says this particular object, how much ambient light or how much of the ambient light in a scene does it reflect? And this IAMP is really global for all objects, and this can be chosen per object to fine-tune this ambient part for all objects. So it's really fine-tuning. Okay, so that one is trivial. Here you see the result. And in fact, this is not a ring, but it's a torus. But you cannot see the difference here. Is it flat? Is it not? You don't see it, because it has constant color. Okay, so to get more interesting effects, we need diffuse reflection. And I already told you, diffuse reflection means that we assume that our surfaces are so rough. If you look at it with a microscope, that light coming from any direction, is randomly, just depending on where it hits the surface. Sometimes it's reflected into this direction. Then here it hits here, then it's directly reflected backwards, and here it's maybe reflected into this direction. And if the surface is really rough, and sometimes even photons are reflected multiple times. And so as a result, any incoming photon is reflected to an arbitrary random direction. We could make this more precise if we would have a microscope. But because this is microscopic, we sort of have to, we don't know the exact surface here, but instead we assume it's flat. And now we have to capture this reflectance behavior in our lighting model. And diffuse now means incident light is reflected into an arbitrary direction. And there is a number of materials that reflect light essentially in this way. Chalk, for instance, paper, matte paint, cloth, unfinished wood. They are all almost diffuse surfaces. And there's a well-known law to describe the reflection of these surfaces, which is called Lambert's law or Lambert's cosine law. And this law says that the reflection or the reflected brightness, in some sense, of a surface point, of a diffuse surface point, is proportional to the cosine of the incident light direction with a normal. So what does that mean? If we have a setup like here, this is our surface normal, and now we have a light source, and now the L is the incident light, and the angle or the cosine of this angle here controls how bright the surface gets. Yeah, so that means if the light is directly illuminating a surface, that means if L is parallel to N, yeah, then the angle between the two is zero, the cosine of zero is one. That means then we achieve the maximum brightness. Yeah, if our light source illuminates in parallel to the surface normal, yeah, it perpendicular hits the surface, then it becomes brightest. And now the deeper or the steeper the angle gets, yeah, the darker the surface becomes. And obviously, yeah, if we are at that angle, so from this direction we get the maximum, yeah, then it gets darker, and from here obviously, yeah, we are at zero. Yeah, because none of the photons hits anymore, but they just fly by. Yeah? And this is Lambert's cosine law. Yeah, it's the reason why here in Germany it's colder than it's in Italy, yeah, because the sun usually is not that high. Yeah? And it's exactly the same rules, yeah, how heat is transported and how light is transported. And okay, yeah, so that's the basic of the diffuse term. Now you might ask, where do I get the normal from, by the way? Yeah, just as a little side remark, we will also come back to that later on. The normals are usually defined as additional attributes with our vertices. So that means, yeah, in our programs, in our also vertex programs, we have for every vertex a normal, additionally a normal given, yeah, that describes the orientation at that point. We can derive that from the surrounding triangles of that vertex. We will also see how to do that. Yeah? So for every vertex point, we also need a normal. That means we have an additional attribute, yeah, that we have to store in our meshes. Okay, and now we have these normals at the vertices, and if we want to know the normal in between, we can do interpolation. Yeah? And we can interpolate normals like we interpolate other attributes in our rasterization. Yeah? We already saw how to interpolate color, and just as we interpolate color, we can also interpolate normals, and then we have a normal vector for every pixel to do our lighting computations. Okay, and if we do so, yeah, now we can apply Lambert's cosine law, and here we see a visualization of this effect here. If we have a light source that is really here at the sort of highest position, yeah, highest possible position, incident light directly comes from the normal direction, and then the reflected light, first of all, is uniform into all directions, yeah. That's the definition of diffuse. And the magnitude depends on this angle. So here it's maximal. And if the sun goes down, then it becomes less and less. Yeah. And if the sun is here at the horizon, then we would have zero at this point. Yeah. And the decay is just described by the cosine of this angle. And if we, now here, this is a simple polar plot that tells us if light comes from this direction, how large is the reflections? Yeah, so this is the from this direction. If light comes from this direction and we scale this by the cosine, we get this sphere shape again. Yeah, that's a geometric property. Yeah, that tells us how we can visualize this cosine. Okay. Good. How can that be explained? Or why is it the cosine? That's rather simple to explain. Because imagine we have sunlight, yeah? And now if you want to measure how bright the sun is, what you could do is that you say, okay, I simply look at single photons, yeah? I look at all of the photons, I mean, it's very many, yeah? But let's say, imagine we could do so, yeah? Every photon carries some energy, yeah? Some little light amount. And now if the sun is shining here, from a perpendicular direction, yeah, we have a kind of number of impacts on photons per area. Yeah, so if we take some range here of rays, yeah, such a tube of incident rays, yeah, then here on the surface we have a certain impact of photons on the surface. And now if the sun is steeper, yeah, here we take the same diameter, but obviously just because it's steeper, the same number of photons arrives on a larger range here. Yeah, so per unit area, per unit area, less photons are arriving, or the density of the photons is decreasing. Yeah, just because they are, we are at a steeper angle, more grazing angle, and yeah, this ratio between these areas can directly be computed by the cosine. Yeah, and this is why how this cosine comes into that formula. Yeah, so it's rather intuitive and also physically based. Yeah, and something that can be very simply observed. Yeah, and this is also how we describe the diffuse reflection now. Yeah, we do it rather similar to the ambient light. We say the diffuse light is, yeah, okay, now, first of all, this here is the intensity of the incident light. Yeah, for now it's the intensity of our light source. Yeah, the brighter the reflection, that's clear. Then we have the cosine of theta. Theta is this angle here. Yeah, so that comes from Lambert's law. And then we have a coefficient that tells us which fraction of the incident light is reflected in a diffuse manner. Yeah, not all light is reflected diffusely, some is also absorbed. Yeah, and obviously for a black surface, much less light is reflected than for a white surface. Yeah, and which fraction of the light is reflected is controlled by k-diff. And again, remember, k-diff is a color. Yeah, or if we want to describe color, yeah, we can say k-diff is a triple. Also, the color or the intensity of the light source can be a triple. Yeah, we can also have colored light sources, a red light, for instance. Yeah, and the reflected color then also is, or the reflected light is also a color. Yeah, k-diff, i-in, and l-diff are all color triples. Okay, and the cosine here, yeah, can be computed rather easily by taking the dot product. Because the dot product of two unit vectors, yeah, if n and l are unit vectors, then the dot product is just the cosine of the angle in between. Yeah, so we can just take the scalar product between the two. And you know the scalar product is very simple to compute. Yeah, it's just multiply the components, multiply the x, y, and z components, and sum up. Yeah, so it's very simple to compute. If we know n and l, yeah, this formula here gives us the diffuse result. And we can even go back to this now, to this example. This is our diffuse bunny, our diffuse object. Yeah, and now let's look at how this is computed. So first of all, so first of all, yeah, let's look at what input we need. So here we have a uniform diff. Forget about the others for now, they will come later. Here we have that uniform diff. This is just this k-diff, the diffuse color of the current object. Then we have all the matrices, yeah, which we will ignore for now. And for the vertex shader, we have the attributes position and normal. Yeah, that's what I said. For now, we will need for every surface point, not only its 3D position, but also its normal. Yeah, that's sort of the price for doing an automatic lighting computation. Yeah, so we have two attributes. And what we do now is that we compute the new position of the point. Yeah, that's what you know. We multiply it with a model view and projection matrix. We could also move this together, but for this simple demo, we don't really need it. Then we also transform the normal according to N, which is the normal matrix. You remember that to transform normals, we need a special matrix, a normal matrix. Yeah, this happens here. And we transform it and normalize it again and write it to the varying N. Yeah, so this is now the normal at the vertex transformed, and this is passed as a varying to our fragment shader. And what the fragment shader does is that it simply computes the dot product. Yeah, you remember the slide, the dot product between N and the light direction. Light is also a uniform, yeah, that is provided globally. So here we have a global parallel light source. Yeah? Light is coming from one particular direction. And we compute the dot product between N and light, multiply the diffuse color, add the fourth component. Yeah, that's the alpha value. The object is completely opaque. So alpha is 1. And this is our final fragment color. Yeah? And now you see this simple term here. Now makes a very simple lighting computation, and this gives us this money here. Yeah? And all points that are, or all faces that are facing the light source are bright, and here in the back, yeah, it's completely black. We could add some ambient, yeah, for instance, like this. Oh, one more. Doesn't work. Or it's just not bright enough. Okay, sorry. I don't know why, but okay, at least I get an error. Yeah, but I mean, I hope you get the idea. Okay, so here we're back at something working. Now, and now we can change also the light direction. Yeah, and you see the effect. Yeah, because this here is always computed for every pixel, and every time we redraw this image, this is recomputed. Yeah, so if we change the light direction, then we automatically get this effect. Yeah, and yeah, it's very lightweight. It's not much we have to compute. So we can also do that interactively. Okay, yeah, so that's diffuse. Something we ignored in that example, but in that example it still worked, is what happens if the light is under the surface. Yeah, so for this bunny, yeah, if we looked at it from the back, here the problem is that light is coming from the backside. And if we compute the dot product, we get negative values. There's nothing like negative light, yeah? So obviously what we have to do is that we simply clamp this dot product to zero. And most often in all these slides and so on, if I write n dot l, I implicitly mean the maximum of zero and n dot l. Yeah, so that means if it's smaller than zero, set it to zero. Yeah, it's kind of clamped dot product that cannot become negative. And of course, also for the camera, yeah, if I look at a surface from the back, yeah, we already learned about that also last time. If I have a solid, this cannot happen anyhow. And otherwise, yeah, usually if the object is not transparent, if I look at it from the back and the light source is here, I also set the color to black. Yeah, but yeah, that's special cases and can decide how to handle these special cases. Okay, yeah, so now here we see the object from before, but now we can recognize that obviously it's not a flat ring, but a torus. Yeah, so we see the shading here. And this is if we also add the ambient light, what I didn't manage in the demo, but here it worked. Yeah, so you see it's also also these very dark regions can now be recognized, and we also here can see the silhouette of the object. Yeah, because we have now ambient and diffuse light. Okay, but this is still a good first try. Yeah, but the types of material are very limited. We can change the color, but not more. And the next thing would be more shiny surfaces, yeah, more glossy surfaces. And yeah, this is the result is that on these glossy surfaces, we can see a reflection of the light sources. Yeah, it's these highlights on the objects. And yeah, now the question is, how can we simulate these, or how can we find a formula for such specular highlights? And now here, the interesting thing is that these specular highlights also depend on the view direction. In these diffuse formulas here, you see that the view direction V doesn't appear at all. Yeah? So this color is independent on from where I look at the surface, but for these glossy highlights, they change with the view direction. Yeah? So here at the table, for instance, I see a glossy highlight of this light source, and if I move my head, then this highlight is also moving. Yeah, so the color of this point changes with my view direction. At some point, this glossy highlight comes in, yeah, but it changes. So I also have to consider view direction. And yeah, this happens, or this is now described with the following idea. So what we say is, for glossy objects, we also have such a microsurface like here, but it's not so rough. Yeah. We also have bumps in such a surface, but they are much smoother. And now, as a result, if light comes in, it is generally reflected in this direction. Yeah, but if I'm more on this side, yeah, then it's more reflected into this direction, or more reflected into this direction. But it's not reflected into a random direction. Yeah? It's mainly reflected into the main reflection direction and scattered around this direction a little bit. Yeah? And now essentially the question is, how can I describe this slight scattering? Yeah? So it's between a perfect mirror and diffuse in some sense. And to describe that, we first have to look at a perfect mirror. Yeah? How does that work? And that's very simple. We have a light source, we have our normal, and now you know all these rules. This rule, incident angle equals excitant angle. This works for these angles, but also for these angles. Yeah, and this is exactly how perfect mirror reflection is described. L, N, and R must be in one plane, and these angles must be the same. Yeah, this is perfect reflection. And non-ideal specular reflectance, yeah, is that here. Yeah? Now our surface, the surface normal is not constant, yeah, but it varies a little bit. And by that also the reflection varies a little bit. Yeah? So our surface is not perfectly smooth, but has some roughness. And this gives this glossy effect. Yeah? And in fact, if it varies more, then the more it varies, the closer we get to diffuse, yeah, and the less it varies, the closer we get to the mirror. And yeah, we need now something like this here. We say, okay, we have our surface. If we assume it's a perfect mirror, then we get this reflection direction R. Yeah, but that would mean only if our camera is here on this reflection ray, yeah, we would see something. We would see a reflection of our light source. Yeah, and it's the probability that our camera is exactly on this ray, the probability is zero. At least if we would have real numbers. Yeah? But even on a computer, it's very, very unlikely that we're exactly on this reflection ray. But instead, what we are interested in is that our camera, how far away is it from this main reflection? Yeah, if we are here, for instance, yeah, then we are close to the reflection direction, yeah, but probably then this magnitude here would be okay. Okay, and if our camera is here, we are further away, so it should just become darker. Yeah, the more we get away from this main reflection, the darker this point should become. Yeah? And if we draw this as a shape, we get something like this here. Yeah? So we have a reflection that is scattered around the main reflection direction. Okay, and how can we describe that? Yeah, so essentially, the idea of Phong is to describe this with this cosine term here to the power, to some power. And this cosine here now is not the cosine that we had before. For the diffuse surface, it was the cosine between N and L. But now it's the cosine of the angle between the reflection direction and our view direction. Yeah, this angle measures how far away are we from the reflection direction. And as I said, yeah, the smaller this angle, the brighter the surface should become. So what this formula does is that the cosine of this angle is measured. So if we draw that as a curve, yeah, the cosine starts at 1. So for 0, it's 1, and then it decreases like this. Yeah, that's the would be the straight cosine. Yeah, so the further away we are from the main reflection, the darker it gets. But this would still give a very wide highlight. Yeah, in fact, we want to have a curve like this. Yeah, and to go from here to here, what is done is that is simply what is it phi? Yeah. That simply takes this cosine to some power. Yeah, n. N is a coefficient, usually larger than 1. Something like 10, yeah, or 20. So we take this cosine to the nth, and in fact, yeah, 1 to the 10th is still 1. Yeah, 0 is 0, but values in between are decreased, and then we get a curve like this. Yeah. And n controls how fast this goes down. So if it's very large, or if it's a large value, then the curve will look like this. And if it's smaller, it will look like this. Yeah. So with this n, we can control how large are our highlights, essentially. How glossy is the surface? So, here again, essentially the same formula, but now this angle here is again computed by a dot product between the view direction and the reflection direction. Yeah, so we take this dot product, v and r are assumed to be unit vectors, and we take it to the we apply the power function here with ns. This ns is a material parameter; it controls how glossy the surface is, and k spec is now a reflection coefficient that says how much of the light is reflected in this specular manner. Yeah, so we can also control the glossiness, yeah, or which fraction of the light is reflected specular. Okay, and so we almost have the necessary formulas. The only thing we still need is the reflection. Yeah, how can we compute this reflected vector r? And there's a rather simple formula. Yeah, to compute the reflection of L along the surface normal n. And we can compute that by looking at that parallelogram here. So if we have our vectors n, L, and r here. Oh, sorry, it's not a parallelogram, because this angle and this angle are equal, yeah? So we can compute now this reflection direction L, yeah? If we move that vector to R, we must be back on the normal, yeah? Here with the tip of this. And here the center point is the projection of L onto N, which is the scalar product, L times N. So to compute that vector here, from here to here, is what we simply take, we take this projection of L onto N, that's the scalar product, times N, that's this vector, we take it twice, that's this vector, and we subtract L again, this vector, and the difference between the two is R. Yeah? So it's, yeah, you can look up this formula always, and I think GLSL even has a reflect function built in, so you can also directly compute it in a shader. Yeah, so that's definitely doable, and if we know that R, yeah, this R can then be applied to this formula here, and then we have the formula for the specular component. Okay, and this is how it looks in a real example for our torus, only specular and ambient plus diffuse plus specular, we get this here. Yeah. And yeah, here we see again this image here. Yeah. So how does reflection change with this coefficient, with this exponent? Yeah. If we take a large exponent of or larger exponent like 10, we get this shape here. For 2, we get this shape. 1 is directly the cosine. Yeah. You can also take values smaller than 1, but they all don't make sense. Because if we look at real world examples, let me go here. Yeah. You see that even a coefficient of 10 still generates a rather big highlight. Yeah. And even for 50, I find it surprisingly large. Yeah. So for an exponent, so even values like 100 or so are in practice not uncommon. Yeah, but it allows us to control the width of our highlight. We can, in theory, also take 0, which doesn't make sense, obviously. Yeah, and these values probably make more sense. And in general, we can say if this exponent is small, we have more diffuse objects. And when it's large, we have more glossy objects. Yeah, or the larger, the glossier the surface is. As a remark, the specular color, so in this example here, if you look here at the specular color, you realize that the specular color obviously is white. So it has a different color than the torus itself, which is blue, or the diffuse component is blue. And this has a good reason. Or this is a typical choice, because usually for plastic, for this specular color, white is chosen. And the reason is that plastic, if we look at it with a microscope, looks like this. It has a surface that is almost mirroring, yeah, very flat, which generates the glossy reflection. And the color comes from little color particles inside. And the corresponding color is generated when light penetrates the surface and is then reflected off these color particles in the inside. So the diffuse color sees these particles, the specular color does not. Yeah? So in plastic, typically, the specular color is white, and the diffuse color is the color of plastic. For metal, this is not the case. Metal, specular color on metal has the same color as the metal itself. Just a little side remark. Okay, and if we put all this together now, yeah, we have the Phong lighting model. Here we are. The light consists of three terms, ambient times, so the ambient light, then the diffuse light and the specular. And for the diffuse and specular here, we pulled the light intensity in front here of these brackets, which is rather simple. And additionally, the diffuse and the specular term we have to sum up for all the light sources in our scene. Up to now, we assume we only have one light source, but of course, this speaks nothing against having multiple light sources. And then we just have to add up the contributions for all these light sources. Yeah? And this is our final formula for the Phong light model, and we can make some intensity plots that explain a little bit the different components, the diffuse. Yeah, so this is a polar plot for a particular incident light direction, and you see the diffuse part is constant, so it's a sphere. And the specular part is always such a blob around the reflectance direction. And we if add up these two, this gives these sometimes awkward looking images that describe the shape of the reflection of this Phong model. Here again, varying parameters for the model. Yeah, so for the if we change the light direction, the highlight is moving on our surface, and if we change the exponent, the size of the highlight is moving. And you can play around with a demo that I've shown you and experiment with that. And one final remark for today, maybe that's something to think about. I said the smaller our coefficient gets, the more diffuse our surface gets, but in fact, if we set the coefficient to 1, the specular component is not the same as the diffuse component. And I give you this as a homework to think about. I mean, okay, it's explained here why it's the case, but think about that, why it is not the same. It looks similar, but in fact, it is not the same. And with this, I will end the lecture today, and we will see again on Thursday. Thank you.